Hello and welcome to Gascast. In this after-school science special, we're donning our grey boiler suits and strapping on our proton packs to go anaesthetic myth-busting. We'll each be taking a look at our favourite anaesthetic fable and attempting to persuade you why it has no place in modern anaesthetic practice. On top of that, we have news, discoveries, Mark's Monthly, and returning after an absence, our question of the month. I'm Rick Thomas, and I'm joined by fellow myth-busters Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
And Frank Schneider.
Hello.
So normally we start off with our discoveries, but I've got some good news for you, and I wanted to try and squeeze that in first. You'll be pleased to hear that this is now an award-winning podcast. Bit of reaction, please.
Yay!
Okay, that's a bit more like it. Gascast actually won first prize for Best Oral Presentation at the Barts and London Trainee Awards earlier this month. A real honour, and thank you very much to the adjudicators and organisers for a fantastic evening. The concept behind the event is a brilliant idea and one that is well worth organising for your school if you don't happen to be fortunate enough to be a North East Thames trainee. The idea is that as trainees, we all do a vast amount of extracurricular work in the form of projects, audits, OOPs, etc., much of which never sees the light of day, other than at your ARCP, where at worst it just becomes a tick box exercise with did you do an audit. For the trainee awards, we're encouraged to submit our project work to the event, where they are then selected for either poster or oral presentation, and then showcased on an evening in a mini-conference style attended by consultants, training programme directors, and general big cheeses from the region. It's a great opportunity not only to get a poster presentation or a prize on your CV, but also to network and showcase some really great work that deserves more than just a cursory glance at ARCP. A great idea, fantastic evening, so go and discuss setting up one with your training programme director.
Well done, Rick.
Well done, Rick. We got a copy of your acceptance speech.
No, my acceptance speech was rather just looking down at the floor, not doing very well, but I've got, you can have my presentation if you want. Okay. Did do quite a nice backdrop for all the slides, which were all the idents that Mark does for the podcast every month, which actually worked really well.
Cool.
Yeah. So anyway, on to my discovery. My golden nugget this month comes from the excellent website www.scancrit.com, which is a website run by two Scandinavian anaesthetic registrars with an interest in ITU and pre-hospital care. It's a really great blog, so take a look, but what I wanted to tell you about was the MacGyver pharyngeal pulse oximeter. You probably all recognise a situation where you have a ventilated patient who's horribly shut down or cold and has insufficient peripheral perfusion to get any sort of meaningful sats trace. The solution to your problem is to reach for the pediatric saturation probe, tape it open and upward facing to the distal curve of an oropharyngeal airway, and then insert it into the patient's mouth. Somehow, and what I'm assuming has something to do with the IR being reflected off the pharynx, off the sort of palatal tissues, but apparently gives you quite a good sats trace. I haven't tried it myself, but I'm definitely going to give it a go. Links with pictures, if you can't quite visualise what I'm talking about, are going to be on the podcast notes.
I'm struggling to visualise that, so I'll have to look at it myself.
Yeah, me too. Which bit of the oral airway are you putting it on? Sorry.
So you put it on, so you know how they're curved, and they've got a flange at one end, which goes, that's the end sticking out of the mouth, and then on the distal part of the curve, so the other side of the flange, you tape the oral airway open. Sorry, you tape the SATS probe open so that the two opposing sides of it aren't actually facing each other like you would expect them to.
They're both facing upwards.
They're both facing up, but at a slight curve, so not sort of flat at 180 degrees. They're more at kind of about 120 degrees. Then you put the probe into the ventilated patient's mouth, and I think the IR beam must get reflected off the tissues in the palate, but it does apparently give you quite a good sats trace that's comparable with an oximeter you've got on their finger. But because it's a central signal, it doesn't, it's still there in a shutdown patient.
Cool.
It's when you see the picture of it, it's really obvious what they've done, but it's not obvious how it works.
Excellent.
So that's my discovery.
So where did you come across that little nugget?
Well, I've been so interested in what Marcus had to say over the last year that I applied for a pre-hospital job, which I started at the beginning of the month. I was doing a training exercise where we were simulating a prolonged extrication of a shutdown and cold patient and looking at different types of monitoring problems when my instructor suggested I try this for a SATS trace that won't pick up. Only problem was I didn't seem to have a pediatric SATS probe in my kit.
Very good.
Yeah, so I'll see if it works.
Sounds like you hadn't done your bag checks properly, because there definitely is one somewhere.
Yes, good point, well made. I do need to learn the whereabouts of the several hundred pieces of pre-hospital paraphernalia.
Maybe he was testing you to see if you knew whether it was kept and you had checked your equipment.
Yes, well, clearly had no idea where anything was. I was just busy concentrating on not crying. So, from there, Mark, it's been a big change for you now being back in hospital. How's that been going?
Yeah, pretty good. Place I'm at does a lot of interesting surgery. I clocked up all of the major anaesthetic procedures within the first 2 days, so yeah, it's like riding a bike.
So not what I found at all after being out for a year.
Oh no, I'm definitely sloppy. I keep forgetting to fill in the chart until right at the end, and you know, switch off the vaporizers and that kind of stuff. It's not too bad.
But you're back on it.
Yeah. And so my discovery of the month, as I can lead neatly into it, is a good old-fashioned ODP practical tip that I learned this week. Very simple, but I think it was quite impressive. I wonder if you've come across it before. Doing a Maxfax or dental-type job, so it was one of those where you use a north-facing tube and a straight catheter mount and then tape the whole assembly to the forehead. And that is usually going to slip in one direction or another during a long case because of the weight of the circuit and whatnot, and because the tape is in completely the perpendicular axis to the direction of your tube being pulled. But the ODP I was working with the other day stuck the whole thing onto the patient's forehead using a series of overlapping ECG dots, which were very sticky and a bit more rigid and held it all perfectly in place.
I've seen that in action, and it does work brilliantly. And in fact, this is something I've transferred into Canada, and on the rare occasions I do ENT lists here, I have used it to cure my north-facing rays. I love it.
Excellent.
It works brilliantly.
Brilliant. I will have to give that a go. You haven't got a handy photo of it we can stick on the website, presumably.
I'll try and get one next time.
Cool. So, Bex, after last month's discovery, we're expecting something truly inspirational this time around.
Well, I didn't mean to disappoint, but this is just a little bit of anaesthetic history. Being a real girl, I was talking about the colours of syringe labelling last week, and I was wondering why there isn't any brown syringe labelling stickers. And interestingly enough, the anaesthetist I was with told me that the colour-coded syringe labelling was originated actually in South Africa, and it was first registered from a hospital called Tigerberg, which is in Stellenbosch, and it was registered in 1985. And he didn't know the reasons for all the different colours, but as far as red is chosen for being the most dangerous to be inadvertently given, and that's why red is for muscle relaxants. And there are never going to be any brown stickers because of the potential of spilling iodine onto plain paper and the iodine making a brown sticker, and you would then mistake whatever that is in that syringe. There was potential to confuse drugs.
So did a midwife tell you all of this?
No, it was actually a Canadian anaesthetist. So I was very impressed.
Does that mean we have to get rid of all the chlorhexidine-coloured inotrope stickers?
So a couple of weeks ago, we were contacted by Vishal Dokia, who is a trainee from Southeast Midlands, who wrote to us and said he has designed a free app to help with in-theatre viva practice, which sounds like a great idea. Sadly, I'm not eye positive, so haven't been able to have a look at it, but I believe you have, Frank.
Yeah, I had a look at it, and the benefit of having this as my discovery of the month is that I didn't have to come up with an app myself to review. So thanks very much, Rick. I know it must have pained you to pass this on to us. But as you say, Vishal, and I believe some colleagues, trainees in the Southeast Midlands, have developed an app called Anesthesia Exams, and it is currently only on the iOS platform. And I've had a look at it, and it's actually a nicely designed and useful app, I think. And it's certainly something I would have used when I was preparing for exams, and would think about using if I've got trainees with me who want to be grilled in preparation for exams. And essentially, it does just provide a number of questions in the same structure as you would get in an SOE or the Viva, in the usual sort of categories of physiology, pharmacology, and so on. And the advantages it has over just reading it out from a book or from your notes is that it includes a timer, so you can set a time limit for examining. And it also includes a mark sheet, so it's got a structured answer or model answer which you can actually tick off as the candidate you're testing mentions the different points, and that gives you an indication as to whether or not they've passed the question overall. So I think these guys did a really nice job. It's a nice app. I would just warn you, though, that although it is free to download, it does come with a little catch in the sense that you probably get about 15 to 20% of the questions for free. And I think at the moment they've got about 49 questions. But the rest of the questions are available as an in-app purchase, and that's going to set you back £4.99.
That's £4.99 for the whole lot?
That's for the complete question set, but as I said, you get about 15 or 20%, by the looks of it, of the questions for free with the initial download. And you can obviously download the app and have play with it and decide whether or not you want to spend your fiver on the complete question pack.
Oh, that sounds fairly useful. And Fiverr sounds pretty reasonable for 50 questions, I reckon.
Yeah, it's a good app. And Rick, you know, all it says to me is that it's high time you got an iPhone.
Well, I'm sure that now we've reviewed it, Vishal will be kicking out an Android version fairly shortly, which I will be happy to review myself. So, Vishal, send us an email. But well done, guys. That sounds like an excellent venture. So first up in the myth-busting hot seat, Bex, what bastion of clinical anesthesia are you going to demonstrate to be as efficacious as magical fairy dust?
So for my myth, I'm going to talk about the effect of patient positioning during labour on epidural spread. Now, I know there are many non-obstetric anaesthetists out there, so if you're going to zone out, in a nutshell, there is no effect of gravity on epidurals. The only time you'll ever get the effect of gravity on an epidural is if the epidural is run as a continuous infusion for hours in a single unchanged position. So this means we can put an end to the relentless tilting and turning that you go on in labour ward. Now, much as I'd love to solely blame midwives for perpetuating the myth, I think anaesthetists are largely to blame, and we should be responsible for re-educating midwives and patients. So just a quick survey amongst the three of you. When you were learning to do epidurals on labour ward in your first anaesthetic job, did you ever hear another anaesthetist, whether it was like a registrar or a senior consultant, say to the patients that they have to lie on both sides to prevent a unilateral block from developing? Rick?
I've definitely been taught that before.
Frank?
Yeah, I was definitely taught that.
Okay, Mark?
Yeah, definitely. I did that for years.
Okay, so I looked at the literature, and I think this old wives' tale originates from an article by Apostolou, and he published in Anaesthesia Analgesia in 1981. Now, before you think I'm just bashing his publication, he actually looked at male ASA1 patients that were undergoing elective surgery. And in that particular population group, he noticed that if he had his patients remain in the lateral position while they were having the epidural infusion, that the anaesthesia appeared 1 minute faster in the dependent side, and that the block extended 1 to 2 dermatomes higher. As early as 1988, a guy called Norris published an article in the same journal, and he showed that these results are not reproducible in pregnant women, and that there was no difference in the cephalide spread of sensory block or the time to anaesthesia. Now, his theory for not having this extended spread on the dependent side was that there's anatomical changes in the parturients. So firstly, there's increased hydrostatic pressure of the CSF, and on that dependent side, there's venous pooling in the epidural veins. And so the local anaesthetic spread will not be the same as it would be if you were, you know, as the other study had clearly non-pregnant male populations that aren't labouring. And there have been multiple studies that show this since then. And we now know for sure that gravity does not play a role. Now, patient positioning is not responsible for a unilateral block. So if you do have one, you have to realise that it's either due to malposition of the catheter. Usually either it's gone into the paravertebral space or it's gone around to lie in the anterior epidural space and so the local anaesthetic solution can't spread. Or there's an anatomic barrier in the epidural space and it could be pretty much anything, but it's usually a fat pedicle.
Again with these fat pedicles.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, my new favourite anatomical feature.
Yeah.
The reason I get so worked up is that to prevent a unilateral block from developing, there's a tendency to make parturients labour in the supine wedged position. Now, the whole aim of this Crawford wedge is to prevent aortic cable compression. So we know that if the gravid uterus compresses the IVC, there are maternal effects because it reduces your right heart filling and it decreases your cardiac output. Then there's also effects on the fetus because the uterus compresses the aortoiliac arteries, and that's at the level of L3-4. This increases your systemic vascular resistance, so downstream you get decreased uteroplacental blood flow, and that's got the potential for fetal acidosis and bradycardia. And there have been studies that look at the distal perfusion to the lower limbs as a surrogate marker for uteroplacental blood flow. And they've shown that even if you tilt patients up to 35 degrees, so not the usual 15 degrees for the Crawford wedge, that even at 35 degrees, although there's relieving of the inferior vena cava compression, you still get the aortic compression, so you're still getting negative effects to the fetus. So because of this, patients should be kept labouring in the full lateral position, and unless they're on one side for hours and hours, it's not going to give them a unilateral block. So I think we all owe it to our patients to change this practice and to make sure that patients do labour in the lateral. I think it's quite difficult to get that change initiated without upsetting the midwives, but I think if you take the chance to try and explain this to the patients while the midwives are in the room, hopefully they will learn as a side effect. And hopefully in the future we'll have all patients labouring laterally and not be teaching them this rubbish about having to lie on each side for certain lengths of time and make them uncomfortable.
So, wait a minute. So if you go to put an epidural in and the patient's lying on the side and you leave them on that side for the whole time and put your full top-up in, are you telling me that that will work equally on both sides?
Yeah, it will.
Cool. What about upwards and downwards spreads? So if you're topping up for a section?
Yeah, no difference. And there's no difference. If you put them head down, it's not going to increase the spread. And if you sit people up because they've got sacral sensation, you're not going to get, your gravity is not going to help change your sacral sensation. So it's just, it's coincidental. You'll give a top up and you'll think, oh, wow, look how the block has come up while they're in the head down position. But it is actually just coincidental that you gave them the volume, which increased the spread. And we know from what I've discussed before, it's the physiology of the epidural space. So you give a bolus, and that's your best opportunity to get fluid to spread in the epidural space. And it's the volume that makes it spread. It's not the position.
So what you're saying, if you want a higher block, put more in one go in a bolus.
Yeah, as a rapid infusion, yeah.
Thank you.
Pleasure. But seriously, don't you think that's amazing? I never knew this about epidurals till I started at Mount Sinai.
You do realise we're never going to convince midwives of that, and they're still going to be turned like roasting chickens.
Come up with my line though. It's just I say to the patients.
But that's why they're myths.
No, but this is the point. I say to the patients, previously we used to believe that gravity played a role. Now we know that's very old-fashioned thinking, and we've got lots of evidence to prove that it doesn't facilitate the spread of the block. And most people are comfortable lying on one side or the other. So that's how we'd like you to lie. Please don't lie on the back. It's bad for your baby. And then the midwives can't get these patients to lie on the back for love or money because you've said it's bad for the baby.
Do you just give them the full 20 mils straight off then, or do you still go half and half?
So we have a different... they've done some studies where I'm currently working about the ED95 of bupivacaine as a loading dose.
What to do?
You take...
Just keep it
10
sweet.
Mils,
listen, March on call tomorrow and he really needs to know what to do.
Okay, you give them 10 mils of 0.125%, lying on one side as a single shot with 50 mics of fentanyl, and they'll be comfortable within 8 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
10 mils of 0.125 as a single shot, 50 mics of fentanyl.
Cool. So thank you very much, Bex. That is our first myth busted. Turning patients with epidurals to stop a unilateral block is useless.
Totally.
Completely useless. So thank you very much for that. I will certainly not be doing that again ever, because I'll never be doing obstetrics ever again.
How can you have escaped obstetrics for the rest of your career now?
I have. I've got the rest of my... I know what I'm doing now, and...
Oopies forever.
Well done.
It's actually quite scary. I'll never do any obstetrics before I'm a consultant. I'll never do any more peds before I'm a consultant, which is quite frightening. If you see me in East Tars Charles.
You can ring me about the obstetric questions. I find somebody else to ask about the peds ones, but...
So before we go on to our next myth, I just wanted to bring back question of the month. because I was on a pre-hospital course recently for my new job, where a big component of it is doing rapid sequence inductions in the pre-hospital setting. So it's not just anaesthetists who are doing it there, it's a lot of A&E, or as I've now discovered, they've recently changed their name to ED physicians.
Oh, well, here we're calling them emerge physicians.
Yeah. So I think I prefer that.
But anyway, one of the ED doctors asked me a, on the face of it, very simple airway question, which I was struggling to come up with a nice succinct answer for. And that question was, why, when you've got a bougie down and you're struggling to get an ET tube through the cords, do you rotate it anti-clockwise as opposed to clockwise?
Do you want us to answer this, or is this for the listeners?
Yeah, no, by all means. If you know the answer, then please, go ahead.
It's got to be because of the shape of the tip, hasn't it?
You've got the bevel sideways on. You turn a quarter turn clockwise, and that's facing the bevel at a right way to bounce over the soft tissues.
Now, Mark will just update the...
But what do you mean? What soft tissues?
Not soft tissues. Over your cords. The way you're going to tip it, it's going to get... It's going to swing between
the top of the vernacular that it's going to snag on, where the bougie's kind of close to that. And if you think of the tube as you insert it, it's normally going to be with a bevel from left to right, so that the most distal tip is on the 3 o'clock position. So you rotate it 90 degrees, so that pointy bit's at the bottom position. That's why you do it.
Okay, I'm struggling to imagine it in my head a bit, but you're saying you won't get the same effect on the soft tissues if you turn it clockwise?
Well, no, you'd be moving the bevel, it would be pointing 180 degrees in the opposite direction then.
Yeah, but wouldn't that be just as good?
Well, no, because the bougie's coming round a corner, so it's going to be impinging on the superior part of the glottis as it comes through. So you want to point the bevel away from that. It's hard to describe without diagrams.
We need diagrams on the website. When I was doing airway stuff at Georgia's, that's what I was taught as well. It was to do with the orientation of the bevel.
The angle, yeah.
But
it'd be nice to have it a bit more succinct than that, wouldn't it? I mean, we don't, you know, this is not one clear answer to reproduce to an ED physician. We're still all bumbling about the physics and that. It'd be nice to have it in a very succinct manner.
I looked at the ET tube and then I thought, right, the only obvious asymmetrical bit of this is the bevel, which is generally left facing. But then I was trying to sort of reconstruct and think of the anatomy. And then I thought, I can't see what difference it's going to make if you go clockwise or if you go anti-clockwise, where the bevel's going to end up facing...
Well, it depends how much you turn. Obviously, if you turn 180 degrees in either direction, it's going to be the same, but you're only doing a quarter turn, so what that's by going clockwise you're pointing the bevel upwards, by going anti-clockwise you'd be pointing the bevel downwards.
Well, we're definitely lacking a truly succinct answer to our question, so if anybody listening can help us out, preferably with diagrams, please let us know and we may be able to organise some kind of book-based prize for you. So back to our myths. Frank, I believe you're going to be reinventing one of my favourite anaesthetic aid memoirs concerning the appropriate use of cuffs on ET tubes in the paediatric population.
Well, I don't know about that, Rick, but I am interested in finding out what you guys think about cuffed paediatric ET tubes. And the myth here really is that cuff tubes are unsafe in paediatrics, or certainly shouldn't be considered in anyone under the age of 8. And I suppose my first exposure with cuff tubes, or routine use of cuff tubes, was when I worked on PICU a few years ago, and having just rotated back onto a paediatric intensive care unit, I'm still surprised that some people are still very averse to using cuff tubes. I think the acceptance of cuff tubes was really hindered by traditional teaching and what most textbooks used to say, as well as concerns regarding airway injuries and obviously subglottic stenosis, and the fact that the tubes that are currently available used to be available were generally technically unsatisfactory. Obviously, anyone who's seen the newer design of cuff pediatric tubes will know that that's certainly changed, but there still seems to be a lot of argument about whether or not cuff tubes should be used in the pediatric population. One of the people that seems to have done a lot of work on this is Marcus Weiss, who seems to be a pediatric anaesthetist based in Switzerland. And he certainly discloses, and I should probably lead in by saying that he has been involved in designing one of the new generation cuff pediatric ET tubes. But he's done quite a lot of interesting work. One of the articles he wrote in the BJA back in 2004 was describing the shortcomings of cuff pediatric tubes. And essentially, there were a number of manufacturers that were making these, but they all varied in terms of what the actual outer diameters were for each respective internal diameter, the position of the cuff, whether or not they had markings for the correct insertion length, and the fact that they varied and didn't always correlate according to the intubation formulas that we use in pediatrics, that didn't correlate with the actual anatomical dimensions. As far as I can see, though, with the new designs of cuff pediatric tubes, we should really be using them more routinely, although, like anything, they have specific indications. But I think certainly for cases that are going to be intubated long-term or that are going to have changes in airway swelling, for example, or in whom ventilation is difficult, cuff pediatric tubes have been shown, and subsequent work by Marcus Weiss, to prevent unnecessary tube changes to anywhere to sort of 20 or 30% of cases. And again, a number of studies have been shown by him and other authors that there is actually no increased incidence of airway injury, subglottic stenosis, or laryngomalacia, whether you use a cuffed or an uncuffed tube. And in fact, probably most of that is due to incorrect tube sizes being used, and most of that tended to be uncuffed tubes in any case. So I don't know what everyone else's practice has been or how much pediatrics you guys do these days. And Rick, you seem to have strong feelings on use of cuffed tubes.
I wouldn't say I've got incredibly strong feelings. I have just come off doing a pediatric block, and I was quite surprised at the still very widespread use of uncuffed tubes, especially for operations that I think it's a bit crazy not to, like tonsillectomies and that sort of stuff. But still people doing them on south-facing rays uncuffed, which just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Well, I think one of the arguments for cuffed preformed tubes is that the designs were often flawed, and the cuff would end up either around the cricoid or actually in between the cords, and obviously could cause damage there. And I think a lot of people were unkeen on them for that reason. So again, I suppose you do need to choose the right tube. And I don't, to be honest, our hospital still doesn't use the new tubes. And I think one of the big arguments against using cuff tubes or using them routinely is that they are significantly more expensive than either uncuffed tubes or the older design of cuff tubes.
But anything that saves tube changes has got to be good, because the amount of time I spend putting the wrong size tube, and always too small, because I'm always a bit concerned about putting tubes that are too big into pediatric patients. So inevitably, the size ends up being a little bit too small. There's a big air leak. Whereas, you know, cuff tube down, boom, cuff up, no problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I've been trying to use them routinely, certainly on PICU for ventilation, because it does just give you the opportunity to adjust for a leak. And although we tend to still leave a small leak behind, but obviously as sedation changes, as children wake up, or ventilation strategies change, or if you do need higher pressures, then having a cuff and having the ability to then compensate for changes in leak allow you to use the same tube without having to put a patient at the risk of a tube change.
Bex, you've done loads of PICU, haven't you?
6 months, I don't know. I was leaning towards the cuffed tubes for exactly those reasons that you know, you can have this cuff and you can let air in and out as you need. But then one of the articles that Frank emailed us was talking about how if you properly deflate the cuff, you get the really sharp folds and edges, and if children are on ventilators and tubes aren't secured, you know, that can move up and down with the respiratory cycle, and you can actually sort of get a grating effect on the mucosa. So that was just something that had never occurred to me, because I'd always felt quite safe about deflating cuffs completely on the pediatric intensive care, and actually that might be aggravating long-term tracheal injury. So that was just something that made me think. Certainly, I think in people who are not paediatric anaesthetists, so somebody like me who's just going to be an occasional paediatric intubator, probably the fewer changes that you have instrumenting a child's airway, the better. And so for that reason, I think, yeah, the cuff tubes are a good idea because there's, you know, potential for any kind of airway emergency or laryngospasm with repeated airway changes. So, yeah, I mean, all in all, I probably would go for a cuff tube, but I did like the way that they sort of seem to emphasize that actually not whether a tube is cuffed or uncuffed, but it's the vigilance of the anaesthetist, that you make sure you haven't inserted it too far so you get an intrabronchial intubation, and that you monitor cuff pressures because of the lower perfusion pressure of the pediatric mucosa. And so that, you know, the pediatric airway is actually more susceptible to damage than the adult airway. And certainly in hospitals where I've worked, those cuff manometers are few and far between. So I suppose if you're going to use nitrous oxide, and many people do in pediatrics, you'd have to make sure you have one of those available for long cases.
Again, actually, at the Barts at London Trainee Award Ceremony, which I was at just the other day.
Just dropping it
where,
in again.
Where you were a prize winner.
Just
yeah, first
where I was
prize
a prize winner.
Winner,
if I can shoehorn that in again. But one of the prize-winning audits was one of my favourite stealth audits, which was going around and on unsuspecting anaesthetists in theatre and then measuring their cuff pressures. And, of course, they were all way, way over what they should be.
Now, you see, I've done a similar audit, but actually people had overinflated the laryngeal masks more than the ET tubes.
Oh, they're the worst ones.
So it's not to say that using a laryngeal mask is your get-out-of-jail-free card.
But, yeah, people love to overinflate laryngeal masks.
I'm sure they're a bigger cause of pain than endotracheal tubes. Anyway, that's we've moved nicely away from pediatric cuff tubes.
How low can you go down to in age-wise on pediatric cuff tubes?
Well, they do actually manufacture a size 3 cuffed, and on the reading up I was doing was that if with a 3 cuffed you still don't get a leak even with the cuff down, and these are obviously proponents of cuffed tube use, would then put an uncuffed size 3 down with a throat pack.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, so they are available right down to size 3, again, from sort of the new manufacturers. And I think we probably are going to be seeing more and more manufacturers starting to produce these new style, new generation cuff tubes. And I imagine in time, and as the cost per unit comes down, I would imagine that they would become more widely accepted.
Great. So thank you, Frank. Use cuff tubes in peds with confidence. We're gonna have to make up a new rhyme for that as well, aren't we?
Didn't you like mine?
No muff, no cuff.
We can't use that anymore. No. We need something more like
no muff,
no problem. Or something that's less likely to get us arrested, bearing in mind we're publishing this on the internet. The internet takes a very dim view to this kind of chat. Anyway, so moving on from that to what's quickly becoming my favourite feature of the podcast, Mark's Monthly. So, Mark, what has really got your goat that you need to get off your chest this month?
I might need a couple of goes at this because it's quite hard to get it all done in a minute. Is someone going to do a timer?
I'll do it.
I think
me,
that's...
me. Hang on, I'm just going to open my phone. Okay, ready when you are.
Right, count me in.
Okay, so go on now. Okay, 1, 2, 3, now.
So picture this hypothetical scene. I'm anaesthetizing for a C-pod list. I put the big, fat, hairy bloke on the table. And... The surgeon goes ahead and gives him one anyway. Happy days.
Okay, stop. Beautiful.
We can't use that.
No.
I mean, there are so many issues with that. Don't even know where to begin. Well, on the upside, we have established that there is a line. That was definitely
exactly.
It. We just don't quite know where it sits. So I think we're just going to have to try that again next month. Still definitely my favourite section, though. Anyway, so moving slightly awkwardly on. For my myth, I would like to start with a little anecdote. Quite a few years ago, when I was working on ITU at a small DGH, I was looking after a little old lady with known mitral valve disease who was with us for management of her sepsis secondary to a UTI. She was quite sick, but still at the antibiotic and goal-directed fluid management stage of her therapy, for which I'd inserted a central line. As a patient with known mitral valve disease and on a regular dose of diuretics, she was swiftly reviewed by the cardiology consultant with his registrar in tow. They both obviously knew the patient from clinic and quickly began their examination, which began with a very careful visual interrogation of her JVP. After about a minute of intense staring and occasional prodding, they both declared her JVP to be raised at 10 to 12 centimetres. However, given her current state, and it would not be a good idea to reintroduce her diuretics yet, and judicious fluid management was the order of the day. At the time, I was actually looking at the CVP reading on the monitor from the line I just inserted, which was reading 1. In keeping, I thought, with her crispy dryness, but still 1 and not 10 to 12. So having reflected on this over a number of years now, I think one, or possibly more, of three things must have been going on. Number one, the cardiologist couldn't in fact see the JVP. Personally, I rarely can, but I certainly have pretended to as a junior doctor, especially when more senior clinicians have been at pains to point it out to me. Number two, her CVP reading on the monitor is unrelated to her jugular venous pressure waveform, although that seems extremely unlikely. Or number three, her CVP or JVP measurement has nothing whatsoever to do with her filling state or response to fluids. I've attended a good number of talks on cardiac output monitoring, one quite recently at the World Congress, which had prompted me to abandon my measuring of central venous pressures. You may remember back in April on our World Congress special, Roselle challenged me to a hypothetical scenario where I'm anaesthetizing for a sick laparotomy. I obviously need a CVP for access, but do I plug it in? I think I said no, if I had better cardiac output monitoring. However, I wasn't 100% sure, so it's been a good exercise to look into the evidence behind CVP measurement. Thankfully, in this case, the heavy lifting has all been done in one excellent review article published in Chest in 2008 by Paul Marek, Michael Barham, and Bobak Fahid. We'll of course link to the article, which is titled "Does Central Venous Pressure Predict Fluid Responsiveness? A Systematic Review of the Literature." In their review, the authors have attempted to answer three questions. Number one, is there a relationship between CVP and blood volume? Number two, can CVP predict fluid responsiveness? And number three, can a change in CVP or delta CVP predict fluid responsiveness? And I'll just do a quick straw poll. Mark, starting with you, CVP measurement, do you use it to guide your fluid management?
Sometimes.
Sometimes? And what do you do? Do you look at the baseline, or do you give some fluids?
Yeah, I would see which way it's trending, and if it, you know, goes up a lot, stop giving fluids.
Bex?
I remember there was that trial. It came out of Australia, and it was about, I don't know, it was certainly when I did my first ICU block, people were telling me about it, that you give some fluid, and if you get a sustained rise in the CVP then by 3, then you off full and you should stop giving fluids. So I certainly believe in that for a while. Now I'm not so sure. I prefer a slightly more advanced modes of monitoring. But it's a number, isn't it? And I think it just adds to the whole picture. But I wouldn't take it as fact. It's like the urine output. I think as an individual number, they're probably not particularly very good.
That was an exceptionally woolly answer, but thank you.
Well, it is, exactly. I mean, I haven't done any CVPs in about 2 years. But no, I wouldn't use them as an isolated monitor, no.
Okay, and Frank, as a cardiac anaesthetist.
Yeah, I would use it if I had nothing else or better, I would use it as a trend monitor. But I don't think it's very useful.
So there we are. 100% of you would use it in some form to... Well, you would use it to inform your decisions about fluids, basically. Yeah. So, coming back to my systematic review, as with any review of this type, they've carefully declared their search terms and trial identification. The papers they were interested in reported outcome variables for correlation between CVP and blood volume, and correlation or ROC analysis for CVP or delta CVP and cardiac output or stroke index. So after whittling it down from 206 citations, they selected 24 papers for analysis. As a rough guide, the papers measuring blood volume were using radio-labeled albumin or indocyanine in green, and the papers measuring cardiac output or stroke index were using a combination of pulmonary artery catheters, thermodilution, TOE, and radionuclide scintigraphy as their comparable standard. So what did they find? First off, looking at the relationship between CVP and circulating blood volume. Five studies were looking at this relationship, the earliest published in 1975, the most recent in 2006. And here comes the statistical part. All of these studies published a correlation coefficient, R. Correlation looks at the strength of the relationship between two variables, and therefore how well one can be predicted from the other. The R value given to measure the strength of the relationship is a number between 0 and 1, which can be either positive or negative, dependent on the direction of the correlation.
In that case, it's zero. A number between minus 1 and 1.
Okay, fair enough. It is. You're absolutely right. So 0 implies no correlation.
The stats fail.
I'm all right at stats. I'm not very good with numbers. I really struggle with integers, and especially positives and minuses. But anyway, so yeah, thank you, Mark. You're quite right. 0 implies no correlation. 1 is a perfect positive correlation, and minus 1 a perfect negative correlation. And just looking at the positive side here, but obviously the same is true for the negative side, 0 to 0.3 is taken to be weakly positive, 0.3 to 0.7 as moderately positive, and 0.7 to 1 as a strong positive correlation. The R values in the studies assessed ranged from 0.02 to 0.27 at the top end, which when pulled and weighted by the authors gave an R of 0.16, virtually no correlation whatsoever between CVP and blood volume. So does CVP measurement give you an indication of filling status? Emphatically no from this particular review. Turning our attention to the more contentious issue of CVP measurement or change in CVP measurement and fluid responsiveness, we have more data to play with. I actually remember, just as Bex has described, being schooled fairly recently by a professor of intensive care on the art of giving a 200ml fluid challenge, watching the CVP go up, then if it came down again, giving another fluid bolus until the CVP went up and stayed up. Again, the authors looked at reported R values, pulled and weighted them, to give a total R of 0.18 for baseline CVP measurement and change in stroke volume in response to fluid, and an even lower R of 0.11 between change in CVP and stroke index or cardiac output. Many of the papers also used ROC curves, which the authors then pulled and analysed. Second stats bit, receiver operating characteristic curves or ROC curves are constructed to look at the prediction performance of a parameter on a binary variable. In this instance, the binary outcome was dividing the patients into either fluid responders or fluid non-responders, and then using their baseline CVP as the predictor. ROC curves are often graphically displayed, but the numerical value given is the area under the curve, which will be 0.5 for a straight line, increasing towards 1 as the test becomes more discriminatory. A straight line plot with an area under the curve of 0.5 is considered a worthless test and of no predictive value, no better than flipping a coin. So using baseline CVP measurement as a predictor for fluid responsiveness only barely exceeds this with an area under the curve of 0.56. The authors conclude that there is no association between CVP and circulating blood volume, and CVP does not predict fluid responsiveness across a wide spectrum of clinical conditions. Central venous pressure is one of those things that makes intuitive sense when it's explained to you at medical school in the context of the Frank-Starling law and basic cardiovascular physiology. The problem comes when you start to consider just how dynamic a system it is you're attempting to assess. As soon as you throw in constantly changing compartmental vascular tone, the two sides of the heart being separated by a vascular network the size of a football pitch, and the different chemical and structural variables affecting contractility and transmural pressures, it quickly becomes obvious that a solitary, static, indirect measurement of right atrial pressure is going to be way too simplistic. A survey quoted in the paper found that 93% of intensivists reported using CVP measurement to guide fluid management, although I did chase that reference down, and it was from a postal survey published in Intensive Care Medicine, where the first author was a certain Jay Bolt. However, in our quick straw poll here, we have shown that that might have been one piece of research he did not potentially, allegedly fabricate. So... I've seen CVP taken into account on many ICU ward rounds when determining and managing patients' fluid status. So where do we go from here? Personally, and to answer Roselle's question back in April, I will not be plugging in the CVP next time I insert a central line for access, even in the absence of any other cardiac output monitoring. I don't know if that's changed your guys' opinion of it, or are you still going to plug it in and look at the pretty
numbers?
No,
I'm going to ignore it now completely. There's just no point, is there? So... I think, yeah, just get rid of it. Saves a monitor.
Yeah, where I'm working now uses some form of cardiac output monitoring for any case big enough to have a central line in. So, yeah, I'm not paying much attention to it anyway.
I think it's becoming less and less of an issue in theatre, because certainly where I've been working, exactly as you said, Mark, cases that are big enough to demand a CVP line do tend to have a decent form of cardiac output monitoring. But I think it's ICU... where it's more of an issue. On the ICUs I've been working on recently, it's the sicker patients who get the cardiac output monitoring. It's not standard for every patient who's on an inotrope. So yeah. CVP measurement is still very, very widely used. And I think it probably shouldn't be plugged in.
See, but I would still argue that it's like any monitor. I mean, I would still plug it in because even though you may not use it to guide your fluid management, it does or can give you some information in conjunction with other variables you're looking at.
But it may give you wrong information. It may be like a spurious result and an outlier. Then it's giving you, sending you in the wrong direction as opposed to just no direction.
Yeah, but that's why you don't use it in, you don't use a CVP number in isolation. Take that into account with your clinical picture as well as any other parameters you might be monitoring. So someone who's going post-cardiac surgery that's dropped the pressure with a rising CVP, you know, you probably would start thinking about pericardial effusion and tamponade before you start thinking of an MI or a cardiogenic shock.
Yeah, but that's quite a different what I was talking about was for hypovolemia, and so that I think it can be a good indicator in other circumstances. But is the patient dry, it's a bad one.
No, I suppose my point is just that if you've got a central line in or anyway, why would you not use that information for the times when it may be of use?
I suppose what you've come up with, what I've failed to do, a very specific scenario where it probably is of use, which is in a post-sternotomy patient who's got a tamponade. Then you are actually going to see something happening, and there it probably is going to guide your management, or at least give you a clue.
Yeah.
But in to answer your other question of why not just plug it in, because it'll help you with, it'll help generate your overall impression of the patient. What I've just been trying to tell you is actually it doesn't. It is literally no better than flipping a coin.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I do take your point. I mean, mostly, central lines are switched off anyway, and nurses are pumping something through it, and the CVP reading's 240, so they might have been unplugged.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
Basically, if the CVP goes up, it might be useful, and if it goes down, it's not.
Well, no, even if it goes up, it's of no use to when looking at their fluid status or their cardiac output. I think in the what Frank's come up with is one particular scenario where probably it is useful. But what other signs do you look for in a post-sternotomy patient who's got a tamponade?
And that is a bit unfair, because obviously that is a very specific scenario in which, one of the few times when you will generally have a marked rise in CVP. So, I agree with you in terms of its general value.
There are other things. I did an interesting case the other day where we were using one lung ventilation, and we'd been using cardiac output monitoring to assess fluid responsiveness and optimize the stroke volume before the one lung part of the operation, but we were still able to use the CVP changes to look for strain on the right side of the heart during the one lung ventilation and the tampering within the chest.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I certainly keep an eye on the CVP and or PA pressure measurements for that matter, that kind of thing, intraoperatively during cardiac cases, because it does. But again, I mean, we're talking about very specific clinical scenario, not what Rick's, you know, Rick's point is very much on its use or value of, in terms of fluid therapy.
Fair enough.
So from what you were saying, I mean, you obviously wouldn't suggest that even in say, developing world scenarios where they just don't have access to cardiac output monitors or any way of measuring volemic status.
Yeah, I would say if you're trying to measure someone's volemic status and you have no whether or not they're going to be fluid responsive or what their response to fluids is, using the CVP is useless. It's going to give you no information of any value.
So it just makes it even easier to decline central line insertion requests from the medics.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, that would be awesome.
That is awesome. That is probably the best point of that entire presentation.
Just link on the website so that you can all quote it.
Right. So you say, why do you want a central venous line? Well, because I need to assess the patient's fluid status. Chest is a medical journal.
May I refer you to the
A 2008 paper by Marek et al. Does central venous pressure predict fluid responsiveness? No, no, and no.
Oh, that's so. That's brilliant. I can't wait for the next. We get quite a lot of those at my current place.
You need a vascular access service like St. George's has.
I think there is one of them.
Oh, but vascular access is a perfectly good reason for putting a central line in.
Yeah, no, I just mean that we don't get that as many requests anymore because they seem to have taken over it.
Who runs the vascular access service?
I think it's
specialist nurses.
CNS.
Yeah, we've got...
It's who, sorry?
It's a specialist nurse.
Noctis.
Oh.
Mark, do you want to end your career today?
That's a great term for
Noctis. I've only just got that. So do they put central lines in?
Yeah, and pick lines. Well, I don't know about central, certainly pick, yeah.
I don't think they do central, but they do pick lines, yeah. But I mean,
pick lines are great lines.
Yeah, I mean, these
the only people in my place who do pick lines are the Noctis. We're not allowed to.
It's the same with George's. I think that's ridiculous. I mean, Mark, you and I used to do picks at East Surrey.
Yeah, I used to love it.
I was told the other day, no, you can't do a pick line. You're not a nurse.
Moving swiftly along.
Yeah, sorry, Rick, you probably want to finish off.
Absolutely. We'll crack on. So far, we've debunked the lateralization of epidurals, the use of uncuffed ET tubes in pediatrics, and CVP measurement to guide fluid management. But now, Mark, you're going to finally set the record straight. Is it true that cricoid pressure was first proposed by moustachioed American actor Tom Selleck during his Magnum PI years?
It's not true. I feel you're somewhat scraping the barrel for that link, but yeah, you've probably alerted most people to the fact that I'm going to talk about cricoid pressure, and I'm a little reluctant to call it a myth in quite such a blatant way as the other things we've talked about tonight. It's about as close to a myth as I think we can get at the moment. So as you say, this was invented, if you like, by someone called Selleck, who was in the UK in 1961. And what might surprise some people is that it was a surprisingly small and, I would say, weak study that led to this whole charade. Selleck looked at 26 cases and found that three of them were witnessed to have regurgitation of stomach contents immediately after the cricoid pressure was released. And the first thing I thought when I saw that was that 3 out of 26 is quite a lot, because I don't think I've ever seen it happen, and I've done, you know, more than 26. Turns out his basic technique for anaesthesia was to anaesthetize with head down slightly, with the head turned. So maybe having head down increased his baseline incidence. nonetheless, it seemed to be a common sense thing to do and quickly gained popularity. Although lots of people did studies to try to prove that it was good or otherwise and came up with very little. There was a good meta-analysis by Brimacombe and others in Canada in 1997, but they found no high-quality studies at all showing benefit in preventing aspiration. They found quite a lot of reports of cricoid pressure impeding airway patency, and a good handful of case reports of actual cricoid or soft tissue injury resulting from cricoid pressure. So, not looking good. This was followed up by several radiological type studies trying to look at the theory and whether or not the esophagus was effectively being compressed. One group in Canada in 2003 did a study on healthy awake volunteers in an MRI scanner, but they found that over 90% of cases having cricoid pressure, the esophagus was displaced laterally, and in 71% the esophagus wasn't opposed. More worryingly, I suppose, 67% showed a displaced larynx and 81% some compression of the airway. So, still no good evidence to support this trend. Some studies have showed a good proportion of cases of aspiration have occurred while cricoid pressure was being applied. There's a couple of surveys out there showing about 11 to 14% rate of anaesthetists who admit to witnessing regurgitation despite having cricoid pressure applied. Only bit I could find of kind of positive evidence was four studies that have shown that cricoid pressure prevents gastric insufflation during mask ventilation. That's a bit of positive news, but those studies were on a kind of old-fashioned high-pressure, high-flow ventilation, and I think with more moderate ventilation pressures that tend to be used now, that might not be such a big benefit. So, very little evidence to support any good coming out of cricoid pressure. So, is there any evidence that it has a neutral or negative effect on patient outcome? Again, more studies have shown that people have an unexpected infiltrate on chest radiograph after tracheal intubation, despite having cricoid pressure applied. One series of 5,000 anaesthetics in obstetrics in Africa showed out of 11 deaths from regurgitation, 9 of them had cricoid pressure applied. There's loads and loads of extra anecdotal reports, none of which show any effectiveness of cricoid pressure to prevent poor outcomes. There have, however, been legal cases. One judge in the UK did rule against an anaesthetist for failing to apply cricoid pressure in a patient in a hernia operation who had aspirated. The judge said that we cannot assert that cricoid pressure is not effective until trials have been performed, especially as it is an integral part of an anaesthetic technique that has been associated with reduced maternal death rate from aspiration since the 1960s. So, I think that's one of the big problems. There's this threat of it being the traditional right thing to do, whereas I think on the ground, people generally don't have that much faith in it as a technique. There's certainly not enough evidence to advocate or abandon the use of cricoid pressure. I think at the very least people should be aware that it has the potential to make your airway view and laryngoscopy more difficult, and my approach will remain that there is if there is any difficulty at all in intubating or ventilating the patient, then the first thing I'm going to change is removing the cricoid pressure. And I think, reflecting on my own practice, I think recently I'm very unusually the person in the room to suggest cricoid pressure. More often it'll be somebody else who will say, would you like some cricoid pressure? And I tend to feel obliged to say yes, because it's still seen as the done thing. So I don't know what you guys are currently doing, but what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think I'm more peer pressured into using cricoid pressure. I mean, like you, I've had one case of passive sort of regurgitation. That was in a patient with an LMA, in which it was meant to be starved, and in whom we obviously weren't using cricoid pressure or thought it was going to be an issue. But certainly, all of the emergency intubations I've done, You know, it's never happened to me. And I think you're probably much safer just, and I suppose like most of you, or most of us, or most trainees I see nowadays are just a bit, are very careful about their intubation in terms of positioning, you know, having suction available. Most of us, I think, now intubate with patients in a slightly head-up position. I think those measures are probably much more important in terms of preventing aspiration than cryopod pressure.
What was that quote from the judge again?
Let me just refer to my notes. He argued that we cannot assert that cryopod pressure is not effective until trials have been performed, especially as it is an integral part of an anaesthetic technique that has been associated with a reduced maternal death rate from aspiration since the 1960s.
I mean, that's just a tinfoil hat argument, isn't it? As in, I wear a tinfoil hat every time I drive, but I've never crashed my car, therefore the wearing of a tinfoil hat is integral, or it is an integral part of my not crashing the car. I mean, I think that's a ridiculous logical fallacy.
Now, I think, you know, if we're talking about the legal standpoint, or, you know, if someone would have just cause, you know, taking to court for not having applied cryopod pressure and, you know, them claiming that that's led to an aspiration or death related to that, then I think, you know, the bigger the group of anaesthetists that question or query the value of cryopod pressure, the better your chances are of making a decent defence. And I think you just need to find, and I think, yeah, I think the tides are turning, but like anything in medicine, or, yeah, we are incredibly slow at adapting and changing our practice. Well, I just think that, you know, people not relying on cryopod pressure as part of their RSIs is going to take a long time for that to change.
But, I mean, you presented some evidence there right at the beginning that, in fact, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, no, the meta-analysis was that, you can't show any benefit in preventing aspiration.
But wasn't that the judge's point, that, what did he say, that he could not assert
that cryopod pressure
was not effective?
Yeah, so I suppose we probably can.
The meta-analysis does show that it's ineffective.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe at a later date we'll do a legal anaesthetic case-based episode. I think that'll be quite interesting to see what actually does turn up in court and how the judgments fall down. Anyway, that wraps it up for our anaesthetic myth-busting, and we've certainly gone through some of my favourite myths there, although that last one with the legal aspect has left a slightly sour taste in my mouth.
No pun intended.
Well spotted. So, it'll come as no surprise that it's a medical myths-themed biology of bunkum. Where were we last week? So Frank and Mark are on one each.
Yeah, Smith is zero, I'm afraid.
Yeah, Bex is on zero. but this is a little bit different one because there were so many medical old wives' tales that I've picked five.
Oh my goodness.
But out of these five old wives' tales, which one is in fact medical actuality?
Hang on, so one's true and four are false.
So yeah, so four of them are just old wives' tales, one of them is an old wives' tale that does in fact have some medical fact behind it.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
got it?
Go for it.
Okay.
I'm psyched.
Okay. So, eating chocolate causes spots. Number two, sugar makes children hyperactive. Number three, chewing gum takes 7 years to pass through your system. Four, thumb sucking leads to buck teeth. Five, shaving hair causes it to grow back thicker and faster. So those are your five urban legends. Who should we start off with? Frank, you're ahead, so why don't we start with you?
Tied ahead.
Which? Tied ahead. Which one of those, when your mother tells it to you, would you take seriously?
I am going to go for the sugar and hyperactive children.
Fair enough. You're not a parent yourself, but
no, but I've seen that. I've seen that in effect many a time. It's got to be true.
Got to be true. Okay. Mark, your turn to wade in.
That's interesting, because I remember a year or two ago there was some big report that giving fizzy drinks to children didn't make them hyperactive, and I remember listening to hours of phone-in radio show when mothers would phone in and say, like Frank, that the science is wrong, because I've seen it happen with my own eyes. So I think that's rubbish, and I'm going to go for the one about cutting hair.
Cutting hair, okay. Interesting. And Rebecca?
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree with Mark.
Safe bet.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to follow one of the winners, and yeah, I just think that sounds like a good one. No particularly strong feelings.
You've gone from a position of such confidence only a week ago, or only a month ago, to now just follow, blindly following Mark.
Shamefully hopping on my bandwagon.
Thing I know on my trial of N equals one is that when I was a kid, I wanted to have braces because all my friends had braces, and I used to sit and try and push my teeth forward. And I tried it for years, well, probably for about 2 years, from about ages of 5 to 7, and I never needed braces. So that one's definitely.
I don't think you're trying hard.
Yeah, I was a thumb sucker myself up until I was about 12. So
don't start on the bedwetting. We really don't want to know. Yeah, so I'm just going to follow Mark. He's a parent, you know. Maybe he knows something about the sugar. Yeah.
Okay. We'll go with number one first then. Eating chocolate causes spots. This is actually a logical fallacy. This has probably come around because people discovered that the sebum in spots has a very high fat component, and then chocolate's obviously being fatty and having a high fat component. But there is no truth in that at all. That is definitely an old wives' tale. And no one went for the chewing gum taking 7 years to pass through their system. Most of the websites that I could find that were sort of myth-busting and talking about that didn't even bother to come out with any decent explanation. They just said, of course it's rubbish. If you eat seeds, you don't start to grow a tree inside you. So, yeah, good. I'm very pleased that nobody went for that one. On to the remaining three. Shaving hair causes it to grow back thicker and faster. So, Mark and Bex, you thought this one had a ring of truth to it.
Yeah.
It, in fact, doesn't.
Doesn't.
Nope. It was disproved in 1928. and was in the myth-busting article in the BMJ, which I'm going to link to.
Cool.
So I'm afraid that is an old wives' tale.
Oh, Bex, you can put those clippers away.
So, Frank, you went for sugar making children more hyperactive. That is, in fact, the one that is also an old wives' tale, but the one with the most science behind it. They've done 12 randomized controlled trials, placebo-controlled, blinded, and everything else, and it makes no difference to their behaviour whatsoever. The only thing that does make a difference is if you tell the parents they've had sugar when they haven't, and then the parents will always report them as being more hyperactive. So Mark was absolutely correct there. Your N equals one science has, in fact, let you down. So that makes me the winner of Biology or Bunkum. Because thumb sucking can indeed lead to buck teeth. After the age of 5, once the permanent teeth are through, sucking your thumb can not only lead to buck teeth, but in severe cases can lead to malalignment of the jaws, requiring corrective surgery.
Well, that's a lucky escape, Mark.
Yeah, lucky escape for Mark and Bex. You obviously just weren't sucking your thumb right. So, after 2 episodes, that's 1 point apiece, apart from Dr. Smith, who has yet to score. That's it for our myth-busting episode. We'll be back next month, not quite sure what with yet. But thanks for listening, and see you then.